You're listening to a podcast from 702.
You're with Azania Mosaka
on 702.
So in the early 90s, there was a particular series and a crime spree that really captured the nation's imagination. So it was in the early 90s, there was a serial rapist who became a serial killer on the loose. And his rampage really caused women to run scared. They were living in fear. And this serial rapist will become known later as the Norwood Rapist. So Janine Lazarus was a young investigative reporter at the time, an investigative journalist back in the early 90s. And she ended up working on this particular story over time. And she just got so immersed and quite consumed in many ways and tracked it quite closely throughout its duration, not only while the crimes were happening, but also as the court case took place. And the man who was apprehended, the man who would become known as the Norwood Rapist, was Kobus Geldenhuys. And so years later, now, she's written her true crime memoir, and it's simply titled Bait to Catch a Killer. And she joins us now, though she's no longer in journalism. She heads up a very successful communications and media training agency and has taken the time to write about those years, all those years ago. Janine Lazarus joins us now. Hi, Janine.
Hi, Asa. How you doing?
I'm very good, thank you. Did COVID also gift you an opportunity, the pandemic and lockdown, to sit down and finally pen this book?
It actually did, but it's been 2.5 years in the making. Mm. I initially wrote 13,500 words and produced it and submitted it to my publisher, Melinda Ferguson, and she threw up her hands and said, well, this is a good story, but where to from here? You know, I'm an ex-news reporter, and I'm used to writing much shorter and sharper copies. Yeah. So lockdown certainly, you know, I'm deadline-driven, like most journalists are. And when she put me under pressure and said, look, I need X amount of words by this date, I used lockdown to deliver.
Yeah, yeah. So it was 1992, you know, an interesting time, a time of flux and great change in South Africa. It was the year that the referendum on ending apartheid was took place and it was held. Who were you at the time? Who were you then?
I was a young journalist. I was in my late 20s. I was the lower end of the food chain in newspapers of the day, news of the day. As you said, the country was going through an enormous transition. People were voting yes in the referendum. F.W. de Klerk and Madiba were awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. There was the Boipatong massacre. Mm. It was a country that was going through dramatic change. And as a crime reporter, while crime stories will always be read and there will always be crime, the rapes, he started off raping and then morphed into murder, as a lot of serial killers do. The rapes were tucked away on the inside pages of daily newspapers. I worked on a weekend paper, so they were lost. But that wasn't an excuse, according to the late editor of the now defunct Sunday Star, Dave Hazelhurst. He came on me like a ton of bricks, and he knew I lived in Norwood, and he said, you know, go follow the story. And I was living there, and that's how I found that the man who was stalking my neighbors, who later morphed into a serial killer, was operating within a 2.5 kilometer radius of the flat in which I lived.
Yes, but I think how close it was to you is so chilling, because you knew some of his victims. And as you say, it was within a really close radius. You also fit the description.
I did. I fit, interestingly enough, two of his victims, Julia and Jenny, had the same, J beginning their first names. They were also dark girls. I had long dark hair, medium bald, medium height. But when I've interviewed him subsequently, he said he wasn't looking for a prototype. What he would do is he would, for the most part, climb up the drain pipe into his victims' bedrooms. Mm. He initially pistol whipped them, raped them, tucked them in and wished them a good night, and made his way out the window the same way. Mm. And then when he switched on the light, or they did, and they could see his face, he would rape them and then shoot them in the head or the mouth or wherever. So that was his modus operandi. And yes, I knew the girls. I was a very I was a lycra leotard leg warmer wearing high impact aerobics instructor.
Mm-hmm.
And I taught at the Sharper Image across the road from the Norwood Police Barracks where he lived. And two of his victims used to take part in my class. I knew them very well.
Yeah.
The first lot of rapes happened in a building right next door to me. One of his murders was an apartment block behind mine, and another murder was in a commune about a kilometer down the road.
Oh, that's just so frightening when you get to see how close it is, or you understand the terror that people go through when they realize just how close such acts are happening around them. And it means that we're so susceptible, not that crime is ever too far away from us in this country. So that's the nature of his horrific crimes. But he did this over 2 years, and he was 25 years old, and he was a police officer, police officer. And so when you talk about pistol whipping, it's someone who had a weapon, probably a work weapon as well. How would you describe Kobus Geldenhuys?
You know, I'm not gonna give spoilers away in my book because people won't buy it.
Mm-hmm.
But I interviewed him. I was smuggled downstairs to his holding cell after he was given 5 death sentences. And what made it really chilling was that he knew my name. You know, he said, "Hello, Janine." Like a lot of killers, he watched the media coverage, and I was crying because this man had terrorized my neighborhood and moreover terrorized me. So he took a piece of, I guess it was toilet paper, from inside his cell, and he stuck his hands out of the bars and he dried my eyes. And all I can tell you is he looked quite pathetic. He didn't look like the beer moth with sort of, you know, sharpened teeth and claws and horns like one would imagine. You wouldn't give him a second glance in the street. He was a typical policeman with a typical policeman haircut.
Mm.
He was bent. I describe him in my book as awkwardly ordinary. He's a cardboard cutout of a human being. He's almost like a wound up walking and talking example of a human species.
Wow. I went back to some of the pieces that you wrote at the time as you described the scene, as you say that he just reached through the bars and wiped your tears. But I'm curious about the tears, because in one of the features that you wrote, you say that as I faced him through the bars in his cell under the Rand Supreme Court, as it was known then, he looked nothing like the monster I knew he was. And at the time you wrote, long-lashed brown eyes were inappropriately soft, his bowed frame strangely small, and he pleaded for forgiveness and cried, and despite myself, I wept with him. Have you reflected on those tears, what they were about?
Azania, you know, I've covered crime for most of my life. I mean, I literally, back in the late 80s, early 90s, I literally bounced from family murder to covering a riot, which we, as you know, the media were not allowed to cover, but we did it anyway because it was in contravention of government policies of the day. I bounced between domestic violence, which ended with a single gunshot. I bounced between child abuse, bomb blasts. I've always, despite the depravity that I've covered and despite the terror of seeing people die in front of my eyes and of holding widows in my arms, I always, even now, I try to find a sliver of light, even in the depths of depravity. And for some obscure reason, I found a smidgen of light in him. And that sounds ridiculous because he carved a swathe of terror. He destroyed lives.
Mm.
But remember that he had terrorized me and terrorized women living in my area, even men. And in order to kind of find some peace, I needed to find some aspect, some shard of light inside of him. And that's really what my book is hunting for the light in this twisted soul.
Yeah. What I'm curious about, I know in the book you give details about how you became part of the police's operations, the sting operations that they ran. And at one point, you also give details of how you became a decoy, you know, to bait Kobus Geldenhuys. So we'll leave that to the book. But I'm also, it made me curious about why flirt with danger this way? Do you think that your motives were altruistic, or was there something alluring about him, or was it ego? Was there ego involved?
Certainly nothing alluring about him.
Mm-hmm.
What was alluring was, you know, I'm still defined by my career. As I was defined by the story. Yes, ego, of course, absolutely. But I knew that I was sitting on the biggest crime story of my life. I knew it would make me as a crime reporter. So what I did is I broke the basic tenet of journalism, and that is not to get involved in the story. And I did. I became front and center. And what was wonderful for me was that despite the political narrative of the day, my crime stories were leading the front page after front page. I still am a hard-nosed news reporter, and I never, ever let go. So, you know, to answer the question, I think that answers the question, but it also, the book is a strange balance. It's between the questionable ethics of a reporter, the questionable ethics of an editor who allows a reporter to cross the line, and of course the very questionable ethics of the policing, well, they were a police force at the time, we know that, you know, how they allowed a reporter to be used as a decoy.
Yeah, so many interesting questions. And we know that, I think you've also made a point, because you spoke to Gerald Rabaskagni, who's quite an expert in this area of forensic psychology, and we didn't have a unit. He ended up leading the SAPS's unit before leaving, of course, but we didn't have a unit that tracked or followed serial killers. It became necessary, in fact, when in the early years of democracy, when it became apparent that there are these patterns of serial rapists and serial murders, and perhaps we need such a focus.
Absolutely. I mean, at the time, there was a serial killer cop. He was known as Bale in police circles, Pete Bailerfeld.
Yes.
He was quite interesting. His office was papered floor to ceiling with murder victims of serial killers. And I often used to say to him, doesn't this haunt you? And he said, no, it spurs him on to catch killers.
Wow.
He would call the killers his clients, which was quite interesting. And you're right, Dr. Gerald Labaskagni is part of my book. I subsequently recorded an episode with him of a television series that is being streamed internationally. The Norwood killer was right on the cusp of the serial killer phenomenon in South Africa. That was in the early 1990s, and we never had a dedicated multiple homicide squad. But remember the country. There were black serial killers, but black people, black victims, were seen as a homogenous mass. They were never reported on. They were never identified. You know, he had one black victim. It took me eons, ages, to try and find out who she was. And I couldn't get her backstory like I could get on the white victims.
That's such an interesting insight. I think it's going to be great to interrogate these dynamics and the layers that you've described that the book actually interrogates, you know. So I think a job well done. So there is a huge interest, in fact, in true crime, as we know. And I think this has come at such a great time. Janine, congratulations on the book and the content that you've created out of it, including the television series, and all of the best. We're going to keep a close eye and track it. Likely you're going to be back on the show.
Wonderful. Thanks, Eva.
Thank you.
That
is former investigative journalist Janine Lazarus, author of Bait to Catch a Serial Killer.